Now, to close out the last lesson we had, we talked about a concept that I think on the surface, it seems like something only social scientists ought to care about. However, it's anything but that. The concept is that throughout all of mankind's history, there have been and continues to be three basic and underlying social platforms that are the foundation of every known culture that's ever existed. And each of these is unique, they're quite different from one another, and most members of these cultural platforms have no conscious realization that they are part of an identifiable category. A category that represents a very specific philosophy of society. And in general, as we live out our lives within one or the other of these platforms, we either have no awareness that there are other social platforms in existence, or we're just not able to relate to them if we should, by chance, encounter them. We have a hard time understanding what we're seeing. Now, I need all of your attention, because I think you'll find many unspoken questions you've likely had about the Bible and the world we live in today answered for you, if you'll stay focused. We're going to spend this evening's entire lesson dealing with a truly fascinating subject. Now, this matter of societal platforms arises for us because in 1 Kings chapter 11, we encounter a man of Edomite royalty named Hadad. And beginning in verse 14, we were told that the story of this fellow, who was but a small child when King David and his top general Joab decimated the Edomite male population at war, fled with his father from Edom. And years later, we find that the now grown-up Hadad lives in Egypt. He's married to a member of Pharaoh's household, and he's ready to take his revenge upon Israel. Hadad gets word that King David has died. Solomon's now on the throne. And so Hadad leaves Egypt to go form an army. Now, it's hard to determine all the time frames involved here, but since Hadad was raised up by God himself for the purpose of being an adversary of Solomon, because in the latter part of his reign, the king of Israel had become an idolater of some magnitude, then it must have been around 40 to 50 years or so since the time that David and Joab killed all those Edomite males that we find Hadad resurfacing. So the questions that this passage poses are, why would Hadad want to come against a people who had little or nothing to do with what had happened 40 years or more earlier? What did he hope to gain from this? I mean, did he have some delusional hope of conquering this regional powerhouse called Israel with a small army and then maybe turning it into a greater Edom? Solomon didn't lead the Edomite slaughter of 4 or 5 decades earlier. Besides, what would keep a fire of hatred burning inside this man for all these years when he was just a small child when this offense happened? The answer to those questions gives me an opportunity to bring to you the concept of the three basic societal platforms of history, because understanding them is so enlightening when we're trying to understand the Bible, the Hebrew people, the large-scale effects of the law of Moses, the modern Muslim and Arab issues, and the threats that we deal with because of those issues, and even the problems that Christian missionaries face as they venture to far-flung places to try and bring the good news to every corner of our globe, but often they come home deeply frustrated. In brief review, there are three basic societal platforms that this world operates on. First is fear and power. The second is shame and honor. And the third is guilt and innocence. Many, perhaps most societies in our day operate on some mixture of these three, but most cultures are heavily skewed. They're mostly one or another of these. And there's specks of the other two that might be identifiable within these societies. In ancient times, the main difference from today is that guilt in innocent societies were essentially non-existent. Fear and power-based societies tend to be those who we view as the most primitive. And that's because they see themselves as every day interacting with spirits and gods who have power over them and over the environment. And those gods and spirits and powers cause them all kinds of trouble. American Indians were, and many remain, in this ilk. So were the Mayans and the Aztecs. Those African nations that have not yet been deeply changed by Islam are usually fear and power-based societies. These people dwell in a world where living in peace with the spirit world and the gods, teasing them when they're angry, that's their daily concern. These supernatural beings don't seem to operate rationally. They don't seem to have any rules or absolutes. Why they do, what they do, when they do it is a mystery. Therefore, the people are always fearful of these spirits and gods and are constantly searching out ways to find supernatural power sources that to help defend themselves or to even use that supernatural power, maybe a friendly one, to cause harm or affect some kind of harm to somebody else they're mad at. The concept of guilt for doing wrong generally doesn't exist in this kind of society. Because right and wrong, the way we think of it, doesn't exist in their society. A moral code isn't operable in the way that we would think of it. Rather, there is merely behavior that's in line with tradition and custom, or there's behavior that's outside of tradition and custom. And behavior that is outside isn't wrong, it's just not wanted or accepted because it's not in line with the group. Now, shame and honor societies, they are completely consumed with their concern for social status. These societies usually have their basis in tribalism. And they're group thinkers. That is, conforming to the group, that's always the measure, and individualism is seen as being against the group. So individualism is a bad thing. Islam and the Arab world and the bulk of the Middle Eastern societies are strongly shame and honor-based societies. At the root of Chinese, Japanese, Korean, other Far Eastern societies is shame and honor. But there's also a significant element of the fear and power social philosophy present. Behaviorally speaking, there is no thought of acting rightly or acting wrongly. Rather, it is acting honorably or acting shamefully. These aren't wordplays. Right does not equal honorable. Wrong does not equal shameful. Therefore, since there's no wrong to speak of, This type of society has no concept of guilt, as the Western world thinks of guilt. Acting shamefully brings dishonor, not guilt. And this is because shame, you see, shame's not the result of being guilty of breaking a law or a rule. Shame is the societal state of one who has lost their honor. Again, please follow me. Shame and honor are definitions of social status, not the result of doing right or wrong. One is either in a cultural condition of shame or in a condition of honor. And what shame and honor amounts to is defined by long-held tribal or maybe religious customs and traditions. Therefore, law in these kinds of societies is not so much an absolute codified system of right and wrong, rather, it's a statement of what brings shame or what maintains and restores your honor. Laws, as this category of society sees them, aren't absolutes. Matter of fact, they're not even an attempt to create a societal moral code. Now, the Western world, the world we're all familiar with, this is a guilt and innocence-based system of society. So we view all of our decisions and our behavior based on rightness or wrongness or legality or criminality. That's how we see it. We create a system of laws that generally are absolute. And then society's members either comply with the law or they don't comply with the law. Complying with the law makes us right and innocent. And so we're free to make use of all the benefits our society offers us. Not complying makes us wrong, and it makes us guilty. And so now we're singled out for punishment and for derision, and often that involves losing many of our societal benefits, as well as our liberties. So avoiding guilt is what's paramount in our society. We don't want any guilt. Feeling guilty is the result of having broken a law, or maybe part of our understood moral code. Some of which is included in the law, some of which it's not. Shame, follow me, in a guilt-innocent society is just loss of self-esteem. And this is due to our bearing guilt for doing wrong. Shame is a very unpleasant emotion in Western guilt-innocent societies, but shame is not a statement of our social status. So at the core of fear and power-based societies is the dealing of humans with the supernatural world as their primary concern. At the core of shame and honor-based societies is conformance with tribal traditions and customs as their goal so that they can at all costs maintain their desired social status of honor. At the core of our guilt and innocence-based societies is compliance with a set of rules and laws that, at least in modern times, has purely to do with the natural world as opposed to the supernatural world that dominates the fear and power-based societies. Our goal in the Western world is to be right and not to be wrong. Because if we're wrong, then we can be declared guilty. And the law, perhaps even our family or just society, will punish us appropriately. Now, no doubt your heads are kind of swimming now. Maybe you're even a little skeptical about what I've just been telling you about the fear, power, and shame, honor-based societies, because such a way of thinking just doesn't make any sense to us. And I assure you, those other societies, they feel the same way about us. And our guilt-innocence-based notions, it's confusing. It's utterly incomprehensible to them. This is why in our time, when we observe the Western world interacting with the Middle East, both sides are frustrated and angry. It is because we fundamentally do not understand each other. Our values are entirely different. Entirely. How we make decisions are based on opposing sets of things that matter to us. We of the West look at every human action through the lens of right or wrong. They of the East see every human action in the basis of shame or honor. So when we talk, even at the highest levels of government, nothing comes of it. We run into the same problem, especially if we are Westerners, when we read the Bible. The Bible was written primarily within the cultural context of a shame and honor-based society, with varying amounts of fear power mixed in with it. That is doubly so in the earliest parts of the scriptures, before the Hebrews received the law at Mount Sinai. That makes sense to your minds? I want to draw an analogy for you. Today, the United States and Europe have tried to engage Muslim-dominated societies in dialogue, and in some cases have attempted to institute Western-style democracies, like in Iraq, as an answer to the problem of never-ending conflict between us. The problem is, Western-style democracies are by definition based on the rule of law, meaning it's meant to operate on a guilt-innocence-based societal platform. But Muslim and Middle Eastern societies have, since time immemorial, been based on their customs and traditions that define a social code that's all about social status of shame and honor. This is not something they want to change, folks. Any Western-style law that would prevent a Muslim who is in the condition of shame from reacquiring their honor, that's a non-starter. A law that would necessitate a Muslim giving up any measure of honor or accepting some amount of what is viewed as shame in his society, that's a non-starter. So, how did these three very different societal platforms come to exist? Understand that in the Garden of Eden, the fall of mankind, it was not only guilt that was brought into this world by Adam and Eve's sin, but shame and fear as well. Turn your Bibles to Genesis. Turn your Bibles to Genesis chapter 3, please. If you have a complete Jewish Bible, it's page 3, very conveniently. Genesis chapter 3. We're going to read just verses 6 through 11. Follow along with me. When the woman saw that the tree was good for food, that it had a pleasing appearance, and that the tree was desirable for making one wise, she took some of its fruit and ate it. She gave some to her husband, who was with her, and he ate. Then the eyes of both of them were opened. They realized they were naked. They sewed fig leaves together to make themselves loincloths. They heard the voice of Adonai God walking in the garden at the time of the evening breeze. So the man and his wife hid themselves from the presence of Adonai God among trees in the garden. Adonai God called to the man, "Where are you?" And he answered, "I heard your voice in the garden, and I was afraid because I was naked, so I hid myself." He said, "Who told you you were naked? Have you eaten from the tree from which I ordered you not to eat?" The Creator had given Adam and Eve a kind of Torah, so to speak, that consisted of one law. One. You realize that? That was the only law that God gave to them. Don't eat of the tree of knowledge of good and evil. And what did they do? They broke it. One measly law. And they couldn't do it. They broke the law, which is defined as doing wrong. So what happened to them? They became guilty. Notice the name of the tree. Think about those words. Knowledge of what? Good and evil. Right and wrong. Adam and Eve lived for a time, you see, in a utopian world in which innocence and guilt didn't even exist because they didn't have a concept of good and evil, right and wrong. They had total freedom. They had perfect harmony with God. Also notice that as a result of the fall, they became afraid. In this case, afraid of God. But soon we're going to see that they become afraid of other people, of animals, later on of imagined spirits and gods. And they became shamed. Understand, the term naked is a standard term indicating shame. Not in the sense of Western loss of self-esteem, and not in the sense of an emotion, but in the Eastern sense of losing their honor. I want to be very clear. Ashamed is a Western concept. Shamed is an Eastern concept. So Adam and Eve did not become ashamed. Rather, their status before God was reduced to shame. So we see that the basis for all three of history's societal platforms were the result of the fall of mankind in the garden. But was man supposed to have operated under any of these concepts? As fully systemized societal platforms? Ideally, no. If Adam and Eve had stayed in harmony with God, there wouldn't be a need for an extensive law code that would eventually be given at Mount Sinai. If they had remained in perfect harmony with God, they would never have known fear of any kind. And men wouldn't have incorrectly turned various natural things like storms and stars into supposedly supernatural gods and spirits that they had to worry about. Had they determined in their free wills to merely believe and trust God, they would not have seen their place of honor of knowing and communicating with God face to face taken away from them, and thus enter into a condition of shame that separated them from God. Thus, the fall into sin also came, with that came mankind fashioning our own perverted system for defining shame and maintaining honor among our family, and then eventually among a tribe. Now, early in mankind's history, the Bible in Genesis chapter 4 tells us of the first recorded murder. Abel was killed by his brother Cain. And you know, one of the questions that theologians love to debate is, what exactly was the cause of Cain's hatred towards his brother? Why did he hate him so much? The answer is well understood by shame and honor-based societies, but the Western world can't quite find it. See, in a nutshell, Abel brought an offering of an animal before God. Cain brought one of produce from the ground. Jehovah accepted Abel's offering, but not Cain's. Cain killed Abel because of it, but why? Why would he kill him because God refused his offering? What's Abel got to do with it? It was because Cain became shamed. Abel outdid him. Cain lost his honor among his family. Abel would have been wiser, really, to see to it that Cain was given a way to maintain his honor, perhaps by giving him an animal to go and offer to God. And in an honor, shame-based society, the basic premise is shame must be remedied. It has to be remedied, and usually it's through violence. Revenge is an action taken against another in hope to remedy shame. This is how you regain your honor. And revenge usually involves killing the offending party. In another much later well-known Bible story that you read in Genesis chapter 38, you read about Judah and Tamar. And when a Western Christian reads that story, we struggle to find right and wrong, guilt and innocence in the strange actions of these characters. And that's because it's not there. Even though we can extrapolate it from the law that would be given a long time later. See, the short version of the story is that Judah marries a woman, she gives him three sons, and then the oldest son marries a girl named Tamar. The oldest son, the husband of Tamar, he dies. And in keeping with the traditions of the times, the next son in line, the deceased husband's younger brother, marries the widow Tamar. But before he can produce a son with Tamar, he dies. So by custom, now Judah's third and youngest son, he is obligated to marry Tamar, but Judah refuses to let it happen in fear that his sole remaining son, well, he's going to die too. That woman's bad luck. As a Middle Eastern female now, Tamar felt strongly she had to produce children. She had to produce children to keep the family name of her first husband alive. But having children was also how a woman obtained her honor, her status in society. So she disguised herself. And she tricked Judah into sleeping with her when she became pregnant. And when Judah heard about her pregnancy, not knowing it was he who was the father, he demanded she be burned alive. When she informed him he was the father, he understood now why she did what she did, and he sang her praises. So we have death, murder, prostitution, incest, illicit sex. Man, we got the whole nine yards going on here. So what is this story about? About shame and honor. You see it? Tamar was shamed by Judah refusing to let his youngest son marry this twice widowed family member. Remembering that right and wrong has no place in a shame and honor based society, all Tamar could think about was regaining her honor. So using deceit, committing fornication and incest, she became pregnant by her father-in-law, Judah. And as seedy as all this sounds, right and wrong plays no role in this story. In a shame and honor-based society, wrong does not even exist when it comes to excising shame and regaining honor, and nothing she did was even considered in the context of right and wrong. Now, Judah, hearing of his daughter-in-law's pregnancy, scandal, to be sure, demands her death. Why? Because he and his family are now in a state of shame due to her action of becoming pregnant outside of wedlock. And the only way for Judah to regain his family honor was to kill her. But when he found out that what she did was honorable after all, he pronounced her righteous, meaning honorable in this context. So then, because by tribal custom he should have given his youngest son to her as a husband, but he didn't, he's the one who lost some of his societal status. His honor became diminished. And in a typical Middle Eastern display of exaggerated wordplay, he declares the woman Tamar as having a greater degree of honor than he, because what she did was to go reclaim her honor. Right and wrong, guilt and innocence is only an issue at the fringes of this story. And even then, right and wrong in this context is all about how to regain honor and escape shame. Whatever it takes to regain honor is right, so to speak. Whether it's the death of the offender, whether you lie, whether you deceive, even successfully conceal the event, none of this produces guilt because the goal is always to regain your social status of honor. The issue was not debated or questioned by the people of that era. Tamar's actions were representative of the whole basis of their society. It was expected. It was understood. It was a given. It was so ingrained as we can find no condemnation of her in this story. You'd think you would. If anything, it's Judah who is mildly rebuked. And this for not giving Tamar to his youngest son. And this was the source of her shame. And as our final biblical example of the influence of shame and honor in society, we don't have to look any further than Messiah Yeshua's famous turn the other cheek admonition to his followers and fellow citizens. Keep in mind that in Yeshua's day, it was around 1600 years or so after the time of Judah and Tamar. Yet the shame and honor mentality was still the dominant societal force among the Hebrews. Which, by the way, is one reason the Romans, which were by now primarily guilt-innocent society of laws, had such a difficult time trying to govern the Holy Land. Matthew 5:39 says this, "But I tell you not to stand up against someone who does you wrong. On the contrary, if somebody hits you on the right cheek, let him hit you on the left cheek too." We've all heard this. Or in a translation that gets a little bit closer to the cultural sense of that era, since the word wrong is not in, by the way, the original language text, doesn't exist. "I say to you, don't fight back when harm is done to you. On the contrary, if somebody slaps your right cheek, turn toward him the other cheek too." See, here's the thing to understand. Today in most Western societies, being slapped on the cheek is a criminal, can be a criminal offense called assault. One can be arrested. We can go to jail for it. Or it is seen as something trivial and it's just sloughed off. But in the Middle East, since time immemorial, it was not a criminal act and it was never trivial. Rather, it was the slap that was an act that was intended to depart shame to the other party. It was one of the greatest insults that could transpire among human beings. A man who was slapped on the cheek only had a couple of options. Wander away and accept being in an indefinite status of shame before his family and his tribe, which was unthinkable, or react violently and take revenge, thus regaining your honor, and even it cost him or the other fellow his life. There is no right or wrong to it. There's no guilt or innocence involved. Yeshua said in the previous verse, Matthew 5:38, "You have heard that our fathers were told, eye for eye and tooth for tooth." That is, the concept of proportional justice for breaking a law, a God-given principle, was regularly being misapplied because it was being misapplied to cases of shame and honor, not right and wrong. And from the moment Moses was given the law right up until today, separating issues of shame and honor from issues of guilt and innocence have always remained a thorny problem. Yeshua was telling the one who had been shamed not to take revenge to recoup their honor, because shame and honor were based on man-made customs and emotions. God's justice system, on the other hand, the Mosaic Law, did not permit revenge for an insult. So Christ was dealing with the central philosophical societal platform of his society for that day: shame and honor, not lawbreaking. He wasn't telling anybody ever that if somebody steals from you or brutally attacks you in a criminal fashion or commits some kind of a civil crime against you, as defined again by the Torah, that we should just look the other way and excuse the perpetrator. Or that you must never defend yourself or come to somebody's rescue if they're being attacked. And of course, you must never prosecute a criminal. That just wouldn't be Christian. Turning the other cheek was not at all about criminal acts. Jesus gave us a whole series of cases whereby one should react entirely differently when it comes to matters of honor and shame in an honor and shame-based society than what was typical for his day: violence and vengeance. Now I want to throw one more thing out to you. Hopefully now that you have some feel for the nature of society in ancient times, including Hebrew society, you'll understand the idea of a set of absolute laws suddenly being thrust upon these Israelites. Laws introduced from God, not man-made customs and traditions. Laws which were to become the new basis for a redeemed Hebrew society. This was nearly an incomprehensible matter for these refugees from Egypt, these wandering Israelites. God was literally in the process of transforming the standard shame-honor-based society of Israel into a guilt-innocence-based society, and for good reason. Because as imperfect as any earthly societal platform might be, until mankind understood there is such a thing as absolute right and absolute wrong in God's eyes, and that it was not relative to the circumstance, until humans could see that doing wrong brought guilt to them, just as it did to Adam, until his chosen people understood that God's principles were unchangeable, and that their status of shame and honor was bestowed upon them by God, according to their standing with Him, not some fuzzy set of tribal traditions. Until all that happened, they could never see their own sin, no matter how deeply they were wallowing in. So, St. Paul in the New Testament explains the reason for God introducing the law, and thus the basis for a guilt-innocence society. And we find that in Romans 5, 12 through 14. Paul says, here's how it works. It was through one individual that sin entered the world, and through sin, death. And in this way, death passed through the whole human race, inasmuch as everyone sinned. Sin was indeed present in the world before the Torah was given, but sin is not counted as such when there's no Torah. Nevertheless, death ruled from Adam until Moses, even over those whose sinning was not exactly like Adam's violation of a direct commandment. In this, Adam prefigured the one who was to come. So says Paul, and I paraphrase, Adam's sin was obvious because there was a rule violation. Don't eat the fruit from that tree, Adam. And once Adam's sin entered the world, the death it brought with it passed to the whole human race. And it could not be eradicated except by extraordinary measures to be taken by God. But what about all the centuries immediately following Adam and before the Torah was given to Moses? What were the divine rules during that time frame that mankind was to live by? And if there weren't any known written rules, does that mean sin was dormant? Sin couldn't happen. Now remember, this would be a time when all human societies were either fear power based or shame honor based, because up to now, there had been no guilt innocent societies. No definition of right and wrong. And without laws to break, there's nothing to be guilty of. Adam couldn't have been guilty of anything if God hadn't given him a rule to break. For these ancient societies, the concept of sin was a very hazy thing. It more applied to doing some kind of unwarranted harm to another person, or it was some perceived offense you must have committed against a spirit or a god when you experienced trouble. Otherwise, you wouldn't have any trouble. Life was either appeasing the gods simply because they had power over you, or you were doing whatever it took to maintain your honor and avoiding shame within your tribe, and there was no wrong in whatever approach you might take to achieve honor, get it back. So right and wrong was a concept that had very little meaning. And when right and wrong have no meaning, sin has no meaning. Again, Paul says, where there is no law, there is no trespass. So says Paul, just because God had not presented the world with his laws yet, doesn't mean those laws didn't exist in heaven. God had very deliberate standards for people to live by since mankind was created. And even though humans may not have been aware of these standards, per se, it's because of our innate sin and our evil inclinations that we have no concept, or had at least, no concept of trespassing against God. Thus, for the longest time, even though sin was, of course, in the world, men didn't see any of their behavior as sin because God hadn't given his laws to men in a form they could physically see and measure their behavior against as a standard. But once he did that, now men were aware of their sin, our sin. And now that they were aware of their sin, they were aware of their guilt. But if they had also had the opportunity to either obey God or not obey God, and they chose not to, they sinned. And now they needed a remedy for the sin. I'm going to end today's lesson with this thought. I probably haven't done you any favors with this knowledge I've given you tonight. You're going to see things in the Bible now, you paid close attention, that other people just won't see. You're going to understand biblical instructions and stories in ways that other people won't, especially those of the more doctrine-oriented church leaders. While I've added a piece to the puzzle of God's infallible world, your puzzle just grew in size and complexity. In reference to our modern times and the violent confrontation between Islam and the Western world that I believe will be at the root of never-ending conflicts that eventually lead to Armageddon. You will hear what our Western governments say to the Islamic governments, and notice how the Islamic governments always respond. And you will probably predict a better outcome or understand a response that your own government leadership won't. Part of this is because you are now cognizant of something that, believe it or not, most of them are not. The very different societal goals and values between the three types of societal platforms that dominate our planet. How often do we hear, oh, they're just the same as us. Everybody wants the same thing. Everybody. And yet we observe and we say, my gosh, that sure doesn't seem to be true. Well, it's not true. And this is why. But even more because you're also able now to incorporate God's promises and commandments and prophecies into what you see happening, you're going to have a much better lens through which to view all this turmoil and understand what you're seeing. Next week, with this knowledge, we'll jump back into 1 Kings and deal with this character called Hadad.
Help support God's people by purchasing items made by them. Merchandise with a meaning. Products with a purpose. HolyLandMarketplace.com. For more teachings, visit, support, or donate at TorahClass.com. Join with us in worship and enjoy God's Word at Seat of Abraham Fellowship.